Hi, and welcome to Tapped into Psychedelics. I'm your host, Adam Tapp, and this is our first episode. And I think that something that could probably be done to make things a little more convenient would be that my friend and producer, Handsome Jason. Jason, introduce yourself.
Oh, hi, I'm Jason.
So he's going to interview me today so that we can sort of just understand why I'm doing this podcast, my reasons behind it, and why I'm in a position to be talking about psychedelics.
I think that's a great idea because I know you well from work and life and general friendship, but the audience out in the internet world and online may not necessarily know you or care to as to why they need to listen to you. So
yeah, I mean, it's totally reasonable.
This is a perfect opportunity to do that.
Yeah. So yeah, let's get started. And I should mention that Avail Scientific is sponsoring this first episode. And Avail Scientific is www.availscientific.com, which is a psychedelic research company promoting psychedelics through Canada. And yeah, they're sponsoring this and will be continuing to sponsor me. And I'd just like to state that my activities, opinions, and ideologies aren't necessarily reflected by Avail. And let's just leave it at that and let's move forward.
So segueing a little bit from Avail Scientific, we can talk a little bit more about them later on. I do think it's great to see them on the podcast as a platinum sponsor. But let's hear a little bit more about you, Adam Tapp. Who are you and why do you love psychedelics?
Well, so I think some background is that as you're aware, you're a paramedic and so am I. I've been a paramedic in London, Ontario for around 18 years. You've been similar and... you know, just the job itself. And thankfully, due to Third Watch, I don't have to really explain this all entirely a lot. Mm-hmm. That it can be stressful. And, you know, you pick stuff up in the road psychologically, emotionally. And fundamentally, the job itself, being a paramedic, is to make order out of chaotic situations. And those chaotic situations can be a multitude of horrifying things. And you're not always in a position to really acknowledge what you're experiencing until afterwards. And more often than not, as a coping mechanism, you just tuck it away and move forward and persevere. And that's how almost everyone functions.
I think it's important to realize, too, a lot of people don't understand when their eggs are scrambled until they're scrambled. And then usually that's later on down the road when...
Well, and it's funny because I've had like new paramedics be like, oh, you know, and how do I know if I'm going crazy? I'm like, well, unfortunately, usually it's after you've gone crazy. And I'm saying that, you know, that's a facetious way of phrasing that because,
The barometer for crazy is after you're crazy.
Generally speaking, it takes a huge amount of internal insight to recognize what's going on chaotically in your body. And for me, that was kind of what was going on. I was drinking a lot. I was irritable. You know, I was... irritable to people at work, as in patients and my wife and all these different things. And, you know, I ended up doing Ibogaine, which is an African psychedelic used by the Bodhi tribe in Africa. And it's an inner root bark from the Iboga tree. And a friend of mine who was addicted to narcotics. And an interesting fun fact about Ibogaine is that it actually causes a complete cessation of addiction when taken in a flood dose, which is a very large dose that completely floods your receptors. It's like a 13, 14 hour experience. And he wanted to facilitate this to other people, but there are some complications medically that can occur. So he wanted me to help. And so I figured that I needed to try this before I'd be in a position to be working with people.
Right.
And so I did a dose of this and it just flipped me inside out. It was this deep, deep, vulnerable experience. And, you know, part of it actually was, so I took it and upon the instructions of my friend, we had all the windows blacked out. It was completely pitch black in this room. And I'm in there and I'd taken all this Ibogaine and I'm just waiting and, you know, you're filled with anticipation. And then all of a sudden I started feeling it in me. And then all of a sudden I could just see perfectly in black and white in this pitch black. And I have these figurines from traveling I picked up around the world, like Kali and these things from Thailand and stuff. And they had kind of come to life and they were moving around in the bed and I could hear them moving. I could feel them walking on me. I could see them. It was like this multi-sensory hallucination. And I'm like, okay, so it started. And then, you know, started like bats or something flying around the ceiling. And then all of a sudden it just kicked in. And I was lying there and I was trying to sit up, but I couldn't. It was like someone was pushing me into the bed. And all of a sudden I started seeing all these images of things just from work, like, you know, disemboweled bodies and brains and horrible injuries. And I kept trying to like shut my mind to them and look away inside my mind. And there's this very strong voice that was not mine and was like, no, look. And I just sort of submitted to it. And I spent like the next 6-7 hours just doing this. And then the trip progressed. It was hard to explain what else was happening, but needless to say, after like 13, 14 hours, I came out of it and it was just, I was so emotional. Like I was watching TV and there was like one of those beaten dog shows, like commercials. And I started crying, like sobbing. And I'm like,
Sarah McLachlan's totally. In the background.
I know.
Just like,
oh, like, Sarah, why are you doing this? I was just, but it's intense. And I'm like, shit, I can't do my job now. Like I need to have this rigid structure. And then I kind of started making all these conclusions that is the difference, that inside, maybe a lot of the time I am crying. You know, maybe that we're all very emotional. And it was sort of this very significant realization is that we built up these very, very rigid structures around us to protect us from vulnerability. And I realized that that whole experience the night before was fundamentally me taking all these unprocessed memories. And I look at it as like they're dirty laundry that I'd thrown away wet in a hamper.
Right.
And then I pull them out. I wash them, I dry them, I fold them, I put them back in the dresser. And an interesting point is that I was bordering on having crippling back pain. Like I couldn't get out of bed sometimes in the morning. And oddly enough, I was having problems peeing. My wife was like, man, do you have a prostate problem? And I'm like, no, I know you're standing there.
No, I'm just getting old.
I'm like bouncing, turning the water on, thinking about waves and whatever else.
Yeah.
And the next day I've never had back pain again. And it was the start of unraveling myself.
That sounds like an incredible emotional experience. Just taking a look at your psychological armor, for lack of a better term, and just through it and exposing you inside for who you are.
And that was just the first layer because everything comes down to self-awareness. Everything's contrast. Mm. If you don't know that the way you are could be better, then how would you ever know that until you actually have the experience?
Right.
You know what I mean? And it's like I have a daughter now. And she's 5 months old. She's absolutely adorable. And I delivered her myself, which was actually pretty awesome. No, seriously.
You would.
Oh,
you
yeah.
Would. No, like of all the people that I expect, thing, you're like, just like, I'm a doula. I'm a paramedic. I got this.
Well, it's funny. Actually, I talked to the midwives. I'm like, I've delivered like 5 babies. And they're like, okay. Okay. And I'm like, yeah. They're like, yeah. And so, yeah, I delivered the whole baby. Anyways, so it's a bit of a sidetrack.
Weird flex, but whatever.
Yeah. And part of that is like, you don't know the love for a child until you have it. And if I never had a child, I would never know about it and it would be irrelevant.
Right.
You know what I mean? And much like in this circumstance, until you have these experiences, which are fundamentally indescribable, it's difficult to know what you could be comparative to what you become. Right. And, you know, and from Ibogaine, my wife and I, we started doing psilocybin mushrooms,
Before we segue into that, I do want to ask a little bit about this Ibogaine thing. Cause you said a friend kind of introduced you to it, surrounding addictions.
Yeah.
Did he have positive effect with respect to his addictions?
Cause he had gone through, he got into needles and he went to rehab a couple times. Nothing was working and he was getting suicidal. And he went to, I believe, Mexico and did this experience and it completely changed his life.
Like, oh, really?
That's got to be more than probably 10 years ago that he had done this experience. And he still like meditates. He's vegan. He's, you know, it's like he's held on to this and he's just let go of all. And it was a very positive experience.
You tell me the story quite a few times. You always say vegan as though it's some sort of like.
Defining principle. Well, here's the thing.
I just find it funny.
I've been vegetarian before. I've been vegan before. It's a difficult thing to maintain.
I'm sure.
And that is the only thing I'm trying to insinuate here is that he's held on to this with dedication and it's changed his life to a point where he's able to continue with these belief structures.
No, I just had to like poke a little fun there.
He's vegan. Associated.
I just think of it. You remember Scott Pilgrim?
Yes.
When they have the vegans in there and they have superpowers.
Yes. And they probably do. Mm-hmm. I've never been vegan long enough to actually develop these superpowers.
But. Fair enough. I segued a lot from that, but that sounds pretty incredible that your friend is 10 years clean after doing
treatment.
And was it just one treatment or was it multiple treatments?
I think he did one and then he went back just out of like just sheer raw curiosity. Like, you know, and he explained his trips to me. And if you had an experience, you're able to understand it a bit more. But it's almost like this weird waking dream experience where you're cognizant of what's happening. Like, you know that this isn't real. Like, mm-hmm. It's not as if you're completely engrossed and have no idea what reality is.
Right.
But either way, it's deeply introspective.
Interesting. Okay. Yeah.
And then after that, like, that experience has completely opened my eyes to this. And I think at some point I made a conscious decision to unravel myself. And I've always seen it like just... You know, that I think everyone is so tightly wound
Yeah.
And we just don't know it because it's just this slow progression through life. And life's hard, man. Mm-hmm. It's shifty. It's filled with insecurities. We're all trying to fit in and be loved and make it in a profoundly dangerous universe. And everything's trying to kill you. And there's cancer. And there's
every day we're just adding another layer to that psychological armor that we're talking about, right?
Well, really. Mm-hmm. And it's a coping and defense mechanism. And fair enough. Like, it's not as if I'm in a position to say anything about it. I just decided that I wanted to start unpacking. And then so my wife and I started doing psilocybin, and which is psilocybin kimetsu mushrooms or magic mushrooms. Mm-hmm. And so we started doing like 5 gram trips each, and then 10, and then 20, and then 30. And then we eventually ended up doing 42 grams of dried mushrooms each. And let me just say, that's a huge amount of material to consume.
That is a lot.
Yeah, it was kind of gross. And
like, not even just from like a dosing standpoint, but to eat.
No, from like grams. A raw. Yeah. Like, some people like the flavor. I don't.
Yeah.
I actually find it disgusting. And I'm eating this like, blah, blah, blah. I'm like, oh my God. Like, it was, and I broke them up into pieces and I had a cup of warm water, like a literal measuring cup.
Yeah.
And I was putting them in, letting them get soggy. And then I was using a fork and just like swallowing them because I didn't want to chew them.
I'm just picturing, have you ever watched like Joey Chestnut do the hot dog eating challenge for Nathan's hot dog eating? Actually, where he's like literally soaking
it
the
was
material.
Very similar. Very just similar. Not even chewing. Yeah. And so we had that experience. And I got to admit, doing 42 grams of mushrooms, it was a complete and absolute ego death, which...
Really?
Yeah. And that's actually a conversation topic that we're going to discuss in a different episode. But I'll just give a fundamental rundown. An ego death is... a dissolution of your entire operating system that is Adam Tapp or Handsome Jason. An ego death would be like, I'm Adam, but I wasn't always Adam. I was born as a consciousness. And then over time, you know, the name that people started calling me, I adapted it to my identity. And then I developed my identity based on experience.
Oh, gotcha.
And so the way I view the world around me is through the collection of stereotyping experiences. Right. And so an ego death is that just dissolves completely and you just become this sort of raw consciousness. And it's, again, it's not something that you can just describe in a sentence. Yep. And it's funny that people say, like, you know, a picture says 1,000 words and a psychedelic experience is a million pictures.
Really? Okay. That's actually a very interesting way of looking at it. Yeah, it's a million pictures.
Feel free and say look at that. Yeah.
Excellent. Yeah. I'm going to quote that moving forward.
TM, buddy. TM. And so, yeah. And, you know, and then from psilocybin and that experience, which, you know, I don't actually recommend that to anybody. That was a lot. In fact, I came very close to, I don't know, maybe I think that I always going to lose my mind, but it was heavy. It was intense. And it was a deep dive into the depths of who and what I was. And my wife and I actually had a shared experience. I know that sounds weird, but afterwards when we're talking about it, it was fundamentally, and even during, it was a shared experience. It was wild. And then from that, I got introduced to a mutual friend that you may know and started doing ayahuasca. I probably think I did ayahuasca like maybe 14, 15 times. And then he introduced me to 5-MeO-DMT.
And sorry, ayahuasca being?
Ayahuasca is sort of a psychedelic compound from the Amazon rainforest, which is a DMT-containing plant with a MAO inhibitor.
Gotcha.
And the DMT consumed orally will just get broken down in your system. So the MAO inhibitor actually potentiates it. And then you have this 4.5, 5-hour experience.
Okay.
And, you know, it's all over Netflix. You know, it's funny that...
I think it's referred to as the spirit molecule, essentially,
so
like DMT.
So that's Strassman. And yeah, so that would be... You're not wrong. Okay. So NN-DMT in a synthesized form is what Strassman's referring to.
Gotcha.
But you could arguably suggest that ayahuasca is DMT, so why not? But
look, I don't pretend to be an expert in any means. I'm just an idiot with a mic in front of me.
But
so
you have a beard and you look credible. So
fair enough.
Yeah.
No, and I appreciate you kind of explaining the differences too, because I think that's kind of how most people are introduced to it through Netflix is DMT as the spirit molecule.
And I actually appreciate that both, you know, a mixture of COVID and Netflix and people being forced inside their homes and watching Netflix. And Netflix was actually projecting both sides of it. Because I find that most people on some level want to only project the happiness and the you know, it's such a beautiful experience. I'm like, well, yeah, but it's also really scary. And you can confront demons that you're not ready to confront. You know, there's a reason people store stuff because you don't want to deal with it. And whether it's abuse, whether emotional, physical, sexual, or experiences, a dog barked at you when you were a kid and it scared you and you just internalized this or anything, like these things start coming out and it's, you know, it's kind of wild.
So would you say, like, because I know a lot of people do microdosing of psilocybin or other types of psychedelics. Would you almost equate that as to a bit of a pressure valve, like slowly releasing some of that? Or is it kind of once that box is open, everything
comes out?
I
would say, like, I microdose all the time. Okay. I microdose on LSD, psilocybin, ibogaine, DMT, whatever. Why not? I like it. I find that it's sort of a pleasant augmentation to mood. And some people might argue that it's just some other drug that I'm doing, but I'm also drinking a cup of coffee right now too, so whatever. Mm. So I did 5-MeO-DMT, which I think is safe to say is the most powerful psychedelic that you can even come across.
Just remember, you're on record saying that now.
Oh, so. Totally. And people are like, well, LSD stronger based on its volume and weight and whatever. And I'm like, yeah, no, but like a full-blown experience of 5-MeO-DMT, like a 30-milligram experience is the most profound experience a conscious organism can have. Right. And again, I'm not recommending this to people because it's pretty intense. It is a fundamental ego death or infinity experience, which I've had, which is it's something I'm not even going to attempt to describe. And so I did toad venom through our mutual friend who actually had two toads.
Like just as pets?
Colorado River toads. Yeah, like a breeding pair. And he would like milk the venom and then dry it. And then now, mind you, can get synthetic toad venom.
I mean,
the synthetic 5-MeO-DMT.
But is it as good? It's like organic and non-organic vegetables.
Well, here's, yeah, kind of. Well, right. with if you're doing toad venom, and again, saying toad venom sounds so shifty and it's cliche to some extent, but it has all kinds of alkaloids in, like buffonin. I think there's like 63 different alkaloids, and we don't even know a bunch of the other ones. And so if you get synthetic 5-MeO-DMT, which oddly enough is not a controlled substance in Canada.
Sorry, can you repeat that?
It is not a controlled substance
in Canada. Which substance is this?
5-MeO-DMT. Really? So NN-DMT is. Okay. People confuse those two all the time. And again, I'm not promoting this. I'm just saying fun fact. And so I did 5-MeO-DMT in the toad venom and had this complete, absolute ego death. And then like 2 weeks later, I was electrocuted to death. And you're obviously aware of this because you were working that night.
I was on shift, yes.
And then my death experience in itself was like an ego death. And I think it's safe to say that being electrocuted to death was fairly traumatic physically. And
I mean, just based on my cursory understanding from watching The Green Mile and a few other YouTube videos.
Green Mile. In fact, we can just actually leave it at The Green Mile.
Perfect.
And move on from this.
Excellent. It seems like it would be very traumatic and horrifying. And I mean, I saw you when you came into recess, but
I was unconscious.
You didn't look great.
I was probably still smoking. finger all burnt off. So anyway, we might as well tell the story because
yes.
Now we're
let's hear the story because it's quite interesting.
Yeah, so I do a lot of carpentry because I find it cathartic and so forth. And I like doing different sort of things. I work with epoxies and a buddy of mine wanted this. It's a form of wood etching, which uses high voltage DC electricity. Mm-hmm. And one way to achieve this is a microwave transformer, fundamentally stripped of all the safety features, because that's what has to happen. And you hook it up and you run 110 volts from the wall, and then it converts into like 12,000 volts DC at a low current.
Just a reminder, kids, don't do this at home.
And this is actually illegal now. And really, well, the story doesn't glorify it. I'm saying the direct result.
No, I know,
is
but
so I don't know. Yeah, we're not promoting this.
No, that's fair.
But thank you, handsome Jason, for making that clear. That the story of a traumatic, painful death.
I just don't need anybody going out and reproducing a tap, as we like to call it.
It's a meme now. And so, yeah. So I was etching the wood, and I had learned how to do this from a friend of mine. He's got a carpentry business, and I was being stupid. You know, we had a couple beers in, and shooting the shit kind of thing. And I was wearing insulated boots, so I felt safe. And it was really humid out. And I reached for the one electrode. It was on, and this is already stupid. And then I was kind of reaching for the other one and just sort of snapped and arced into my hand. And it was kind of like someone just flipped a switch. And, you know, I despise this pain scale because it's ridiculous and subjective, but it was just unbelievable, unimaginable pain. And I was completely unaware of anything but this pain that like was overriding my thoughts. I couldn't even think or anything. It was like every single cell was being ripped into pieces. And it's not that I was seeing, but in my mind, all it was these vertical iridescent green cylinders, kind of with no end or finish. And yeah, so I was being electrocuted. And I was able to force a thought. And I think it was like, I'm not breathing. And obviously I wasn't. And all of a sudden I felt like I was falling. And I think that's probably the point when I died. And then it was sort of like waking up from a nap or a dream into a place that I'd always been. And I wasn't Adam. I wasn't anything. I was just this raw consciousness. And you know, the experience itself made me very aware of how anxious we all are all the damn time. Mm. Like, you know, if you really think about it from an evolutionary perspective, you know, for the last, well, modern humans for 250,000 years, but as even primates, you know, we've been prey animals. You know, we are evolutionary designed to be skittish and fearful. And I don't think people necessarily take that in consideration, that evolution is a powerful thing.
Right.
You know, you look at gazelles and all these prey animals and stuff, and they're skittish and they're always on high end. And if they're not, then they're dead. And we have that in us. You know, we have become apex predators through our intellect, curiosity, opposable thumbs, and right. destructiveness. But at the end of the day, for the vast majority of our existence, we were hunted. And we did hunted too, but we were hunted. And now we live in these carefully manicured existences, but we still have that. And in that place, it was just completely devoid of anything. I've never been so absolutely at peace. And again, like I said, I wasn't Adam. I wasn't dead. I wasn't alive. I wasn't paramedic. Wasn't anything. It was just this perfect state of existence. And so, yeah, I was there. And all of a sudden, I started feeling this like a frequency. And it was like gasoline on water and all these fractals and patterns. And something was kind of communicating with me. And I say that subjectively, like it's communicating. It was just pictures and thoughts and feelings and emotions, which were very foreign to me in that state. But everything just felt okay, like this was supposed to happen. And I started being pulled apart and sort of becoming the universe, which is a really, again, difficult thing to describe. But and it wasn't scary. It was like what was supposed to happen. Like this is the ultimate destiny of everything, is to go back to the source, the infinite consciousness that is everything. And then I started being electrocuted again, which at the time I didn't understand, but I was being defibrillated. I got defibrillated twice. I was in a ventricle fibrillation arrhythmia, which obviously is not suitable with life. And I got defibrillated twice. Second defib, they got an irregular sinus rhythm, which is a normal heartbeat, but an irregular rhythm.
Right.
Which I'm explaining to everyone else. I know that you understand that. And then, you know, I think I vaguely felt sort of being pulled back into my body. And I think maybe I smelt burned flesh because my hands were badly burned. My, you know, left index finger was basically burned off. My right hand had, you know, third degree burns all over it. And I was in a coma for probably, I don't know, 6-7 hours. Right. But I remember waking up in the ICU and I was intubated. Unfortunately, that's not the first time I've been intubated, but you know, I was like, oh, I know what this is. I know where we are right now.
This is old hat at this
yeah.
point.
Yeah. Bush league. Right. And I had like a, you know, all the necessary aches and pains from just being resuscitated. So I wake up in the ICU, my mom's there and, you know, everyone's all like hugs and all this stuff. But I remember the moment I was able to sort of gather myself, I became like super cognitively aware of my smell and not like body odor, but like my pheromonal smell. Which, as it happens, like we all have one. We're all primates. You know what I mean? Like we mammals, every mammal has their own pheromonal smell. We use it for communication. We just do our best to eliminate it and mask it, which I find funny. But I've been used to it. I've had it my whole life. Mm. But coming out of this was like a complete reset. And I could smell myself. It was just overwhelming. And I was like, what is going on? I remember like squeezing my arm and just being like, I just got downgraded from a supercomputer to like an Atari. And I was really uncomfortable in my body, like urinating, defecating, like it all just disgusted me. I'm just this little monkey. This is ridiculous.
Right.
And it took me like probably a couple months to feel normal again. And it was a gradual change, which was kind of interesting. And then actually I had the phantom pain from my finger, which was inconvenient.
I was going to say for the audience out there, you're missing your index finger on your left hand?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so it was badly burned. They ended up cutting off the remainder of the burnt tissue because it was burnt and obviously would start to rot.
So most likely that was kind of the entry point.
That was the exit.
Oh, so where was...
This hand was the entrance. So you can see like all the scars all over my hands and stuff. That was where it came in and then it blew out here.
Interesting.
This whole finger.
Yeah, that's crazy.
But it was funny. Like I had.
But now you're just the woodworking stereotype.
Yeah,
except
I know.
You didn't lose it to a table saw.
Like constantly. And it is funny that, you know, you buy a new car, you start seeing that car. Like you buy a Subaru, you see Subaru Foresters everywhere you go.
Yep.
Now I noticed severed limbs.
Right.
And then there's a hierarchy because I'll see someone with like missing an arm. I'm like, oh, God, man.
There's a hierarchy. That's better than me.
No, there is. Don't think there's not.
No.
We're humans. We put everything in the hierarchical structures. That's how we roll.
That's fair.
And so actually I had really bad phantom pain. And I equate phantom pain to be kind of like, you know, it's like a sensory deprivation tank. You go in there and you start seeing and things and hearing things because you're depriving your brain of sensory input. And so right. in the absence of input, your brain creates it because that's what it's, your brain's there to filter stuff. And so I was like burning constantly and itching. Oh, it's terrible all the time.
Really?
And they, you know, the doctors were trying to give me like Lyrica and gabapentin and at one point hydromorphine. I'm like, no, I'm not taking a narcotic. This is ridiculous. And so I actually went and did a bunch of ayahuasca. And, you know, there's something about tryptamine and psychedelics, or psychedelics in general, let's just say that they promote neuroplasticity and to some extent neurogenesis, depending on the psychedelic.
Mm-hmm.
So neuroplasticity fundamentally is your brain's ability to rewire itself. And, you know, and it's funny, I think we were talking about this before, like, you know, in the 90s, it was generally thought that your brain develops as a child, adolescent, you're in your mid-20s, like 25, and then boom, you're done. You have a brain and then it just starts to deteriorate and that's just tough luck, Irene kind of thing. And then subsequently, since, you know, people have realized, like neuroscientists and so forth, that neuroplasticity actually does exist in your brain far into adulthood. Perhaps it slows down quite a bit,
yeah.
but it's still there. And I think it actually says, like, you know, if you're developing a habit, it takes on average 66 days to develop a habit. So it takes 66 days to develop neuroplasticity and to formulate a new wiring in your brain, which is sort of an interesting thing.
A new neuronal pathway for
learning. Yeah, neuronal pathway. And so, but certain things can expedite or increase the neuroplasticity from a neurological perspective. And psychedelics are actually one of these things. And
now, sorry, just to kind of jump in there a little bit. Is it psychedelics in general or is it most mycogenic organisms? Because I've heard mushrooms in general, things such as lion's mane.
Oh,
hey,
in stereo. You set me up for that.
Look at that.
Yeah, no, like, you know, actually next week or not. Yeah, next month or something. I'm talking to a friend of mine who's a head mycologist at White Crest Mushrooms. And actually, we briefly touched on lion's mane and a bunch of different things. I find it actually fascinating. But like I said, like it's not as if nothing causes neuroplasticity. In fact, even some SSRIs, like antidepressants, can increase neuroplasticity. But psychedelics are just really, really good at it.
Right.
And so I went in, phantom pain, fingers burning, itching all the time. It's missing. And I go do ayahuasca. And then during the experience, it was like, you know, patterns. It was beautiful. It was stunningly beautiful. And then I felt my hands sort of like that burning and itching really increasing. And my eyes were shut and I was looking at my hand and behind it was like this weird purple background and my hand was black. And where my finger used to be was like this bright light. And I was articulating my non-existent finger and moving it all around. And there was like popping and cracking in my hand. And then the trip proceeded and a bunch of crazy stuff happened, which I'm not going to get into. And then the next day, I've never had phantom pain since. And so to me, that's an example of neuroplasticity is that my brain for how old? Like 37? I think it's 37 at the time. So for 37 years, there was a segment or a portion of my brain or a collection of neurons dedicated to my finger. And then you cut it off and they're still firing away being like, okay, we're not feeling anything, so let's create something. And so that experience in ayahuasca allowed me to rewire my brain and use those neurons for something else, although I haven't yet figured out what that is.
Well, again, I don't claim to be a smart man, but my understanding of that from very limited knowledge is that the brain's still almost like pinging that nerve ending to see.
Yeah.
And then when there's like no connection there, it starts to freak out. So it has to do something because your brain is like, something isn't right, but it should be right because for 37 years, it's fine.
There's something going on there.
And now there's nothing that's responding to this
signal. I use my left index finger all the damn time.
You know? Really?
Well, frequently, I guess. lots.
You just like to push buttons?
Yeah, I do.
You're like, oh, I miss the feel
totally
of an elevator button.
I'm one of those
button.
People where I just look at things and I'm like, I'm going to press all those buttons. And so, yeah, so I find this, the whole idea absolutely fascinating about psychedelics. And you know, and obviously the way I'm projecting these things is that they're able to do these wonderful things.
Right.
And I think we were touching on like microdosing before. We never really got anywhere with that. We got distracted. So microdosing would be taking a amount of psychedelics that would be a sub-psychedelic experience or sub-psychedelic dose. And so you would take these between every day and one every 3 days, and whether you're microdosing on mescaline or LSD or anything, psilocybin.
So sorry, this is something that comes up a lot, and a mutual friend of ours, Dave, with Mosaic Medical, has asked this a couple times.
typically with medications, there's therapeutic doses, there's lethal doses.
Oh, yeah, like an LD50.
Yeah, right, right. So I know you're talking about dosing with microdosing. Can we go into that a little bit with different psychedelics? Because, again, you're saying minuscule amounts, but a minuscule amount of DMT is different than a minuscule amount of psilocybin, which is
different. Well, you wouldn't say that the minuscule amount of like 1 milligram of psilocybin is congruent with 1 milligram of every substance.
Right.
And so fair enough. So
that's more so why I'm asking for a little bit of clarification. Because again, I'm not a smart man and this is helpful.
I'm just a rube. No big deal.
Exactly.
And yeah, no. So like with psilocybin, you know, actually with Avail Scientific, we've been doing a lot of dissecting a very significant amount of research to determine what a sub-psychedelic dose is. And a psychedelic dose in itself is quite subjective. Like, what quantifies psychedelic? Like, you know, seeing the walls, breathing, or is it just a slight change in how you feel?
Right.
And so, again, it's you go by all the research because we're trying to do, you know, data-driven answers and results and treatments here.
Well, you want to make it scientific, right?
Yeah. So, ideally speaking, between, you know, and we're talking equivalents of a gram of dry mushroom material, 0.1 to 0.2 of a gram. So, you know, a tenth or a fifth potentially of a gram would be a microdose of psilocybin. And now you get very sensitized to these. And that's why a lot of people are like, well, are they addictive? And it's like, well, you can't really be addicted to them. And no, they're not. Because if I took a gram of mushrooms today and giggled my pants off and had a great old time, tomorrow I would have to take double the amount to have a similar effect. And that would just continue. Now, 3 or 4 days, you sort of go back to normal with your tolerance. But with microdosing, you would take a small non-psychedelic threshold dose. And then the next day or 2 days or 3 days, depending on your microdosing schedule, you would take another one. And ideally speaking, if you did feel something the first day, you wouldn't feel anything the second and then subsequently going forward. Mm. And now people suggest that microdosing do different things. You know, psilocybin, in my experience, I feel more calm and relaxed, kind of chilled out a little bit. I know a lot of people have microdosed and got over some anger issues and whatever else. And it's thought to be a fairly effective antidepressant.
Okay, fair enough.
And then you can look at LSD and DMT. Like, you know, with 5-MeO DMT is what I also microdose in, but you can actually take it orally normally. So I have nanoized 5-MeO DMT, which is basically encapsulating the individual molecules and so that I can take it orally. Anyways, let's just leave it at that.
You have a guy.
Yeah. Interesting guy. And so, yeah, and these microdoses, I think that over time, like, you know, so let's just call him a family member, was diagnosed with Alzheimer's and dementia about a year ago. And, you know, it was becoming fairly obvious. The writing was on the wall, like asking me repetitive questions. And he was in his mid-60s, late 60s. And got diagnosed with Alzheimer's, tested positive for the tau protein, and very rapidly and alarmingly degrading. Like it was scary. Like I was getting a little bit concerned. And so I put this individual on a 0.15 microdose of psilocybin a day and was giving him 5-MeO DMT, which is actually associated with neurogenesis, with some studies that were done in Brazil with mice brains. And people might scoff at that and be like, mice. I'm like, yeah, well, they're mammals. They're similar in the fundamental structure. Yes.
I was going to say, funny enough, you look at them, mice brains are very close in terms of the neuronal structure and pathways for learning that human brains are.
Very similar. Yeah. And then, you know, like obviously.
That's why they're a good animal model.
Yeah. And so I discussed this with some people who are much smarter than me. And so I started giving him, like I said, the psilocybin as well as 5-MeO DMT. These are microdoses too. This isn't like these insane amounts, like twice a week, three times a week when I could.
Right.
You know, it's not easy to do this all the time. And he actually got his Alzheimer's diagnosis rescinded. You know, his cognitive tests a year ago were dismal and very reminiscent of a progressive decline. And he did another cognitive test about like a month ago, and it was skyrocketed, like incredible, like almost double what his last ones were. And they were, you know, and again, I'm not saying that this was a cure for Alzheimer's dementia, but it certainly looks like it. You know, when we were actually, Avail's going to be conducting some research with 5-MeO DMT and psilocybin regarding Alzheimer's and dementia.
Yeah.
We're kind of sort of organizing that now, which is pretty awesome.
That's incredible leaps and bounds. I mean, considering you think even just maybe 5-10 years ago, that would be such a taboo topic in any sort of climate or landscape, right?
Like, oh, I know. Yeah. Well, and you know, you look at it like in the late 90s, John Hopkins sort of started doing psychedelic testing, and they were doing like those, you know, people who were palliative, which means that they're about to die. They were doing end of life with moderate amounts, like say 5-6 grams of mushrooms. And almost every single one of these people lost their fear of death and had these profound spiritual experiences.
I mean, and that makes sense based on what you've kind of said before, where you're talking about ego death occurring and breaking you down to the core
and eliminating
all that vulnerability, right? Like, yeah, or highlighting that vulnerability, but eliminating those walls around said vulnerability.
And like, I've never been religious, you know, and I'm probably going to offend somebody here, but I personally think that religion is a geographic lottery. You know, if you're born in specific geographical regions around the world, chances are you're going to end up in the religion that's dominant in that specific area. Yeah, and so I've never been religious, and I don't think...
I think it's important to highlight, though, I think you are a deeply spiritual person.
Well, I'm getting to that.
Yeah, sorry, I just wanted to segue, because, like, you're when you're talking religion, you're talking, like, an organized religious...
Well, yeah, and the thing is, the opposite of religion might very well be atheism, but there's a very big space in between. You know what I mean? Like, there's spiritualism, and you could be technically agnostic or deistic or whatever you want. And to me, I'm like, I'm very spiritual after these experiences, especially even with being dead. Because, like, you know, you do a psychedelic experience and you come back and your mind's sort of looking for reasons on why this happened. And it's this weird compound and you're seeing this, it's hallucinations. And then you die and you're like, wow. And one could arguably suggest that my death was an endogenous DMT release, because I have DMT in my body right now. It's measurable in my urine, and 5-MeO-DMT is actually present in my body as well. And trace amounts of neurotransmitters. And it's just interesting on why people even have these death experiences. And this is sort of like a thought experiment.
Well, and even just not having the chemicals in your body to actually have the receptors is unique, right?
Well, yeah.
Like to all... have a place in your brain where that chemical can plug in and actually create an experience.
Well, and they're like tryptamine, so they would fit into the same receptors as serotonin. And so
but again, there's so many like chemicals that we come across in nature that can't even cross that blood-brain barrier, let alone even have a space.
And why do we have these
things? It's like USB versus USB-C versus micro USB. Like, they're actually plugging and playing properly, right?
And an interesting thing that I've thought about, and I've had conversations, again, with people much smarter than me, is why do we have these near-death experiences, or death experiences for that matter? And if you look at it from a very raw, fundamental biological perspective, the only reason that we're alive right now is to reproduce. And once we reproduce, there's really not much any purpose. Like, everything, the reason why we're here is because of reproduction. Now, you look at like a praying mantis, and like, they're, you know, once the male praying mantis inseminates a female, he's fundamentally consumed for the greater good of the eggs. You know what I mean? Like, it's... there is no other purpose for existence other than to perpetuate a cycle of existence. And so if everything that I've evolved to become is to make me more apt at breeding, then why would I have these experiences when I die? Because you know what dying doesn't help me with? Having sex.
Yeah.
It really doesn't.
I mean, you know? this is a good time to plug my favorite quote, which is, Well, I just like it. It's extinction is the norm. Survival is the exception, right?
It is. And you know, and like, you know, one could argue that from like a physics perspective, I guess, maybe not, that multicellular complexity does go against the entire standard of the universe. You know, like, everything's moving towards this being broken down and expenditure. And then you look at life, and life does defy all laws.
Well, again, also another thing, like, chaos seems to be the norm in our universe, right? And just like
organized
creating,
chaos, but yeah.
Well, I would say it's chaos that becomes ordered, and that's what creates existence, right?
Yeah, fair enough.
It's much easier to kind of hit that like chaotic entropy than it is to hit organized.
Completely. And you know, and like, there's... God, there's so many different ways this conversation can go right now.
I was going to say.
Very deep. I'm just thinking quickly. Like Drake equation, and you know, Fermi paradox. The notion of like, and that's actually one of the more, like, don't get me wrong, I personally think that psychedelics are profoundly important for our mental health institutions, which we've been systematically disassembling, you know, like, and we don't really have all that many tools in the old pharmacopoeia for mental health issues. And for some reason, I find it fascinating. And again, this, I'm sure people would shit talk me for this, is I find it interesting that your physical and your mental health somehow are separated.
Yeah.
And to me, I'm like, they're so deeply close related because my emotional state directly affects my physical body. If I'm excited and this, my heart rate goes up, my blood pressure might go up. If I'm sad, you know what I mean? Like all these things, if I'm stressed out, I have these long-term cortisol releases in my body that cause inflammation. Like all these things are happening. And you know, and to me, like psychedelics can start to potentially treat the underlying reasons for why a lot of these mental health issues exist. And I'm not saying that, you know, we're going to cure schizophrenia, but like, you know, the rampant depression and anxiety that people are feeling. And it's like, fair enough, man. Like we've talked about this before. Life is stressful. Life is hard. The universe is trying to kill you. It's difficult. And we're all insecure and we're all vulnerable and we're all just trying to do the best we can. And I personally believe that this psychedelic revolution that we're currently watching unfold, if handled properly and people don't blow it up because of capitalism and all these other reasons, and it's not mismanaged, you know, you could arguably suggest that psychedelics for your mind would be like antibiotics for your body. Like it's, I think it's that big.
Right.
And even microdosing just to make people feel better, or these larger therapeutic dose. And again, I will say this, you know, I've done a lot of my psychedelics with my wife, where we're doing them together, or she's spotting me for things like DMT, where it's a very singular experience.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I think that as we're moving forward with these therapist-assisted psychedelic experiences, I really think that's absolutely fantastic.
I was going to say, I think if you look at like a lot of cultures, okay, to kind of dial back to how these are used, you know, in spiritual experiences across the board, not necessarily in organized religion, but you know, you go all the way back to the Isle of Elysis, right? Or Elysium. God, I'm not a Greek history major.
The Elysian Mysteries.
Thank you, Elysian Mysteries.
Yeah, just north of Athens. And actually,
anyways, all I'm saying is that like these experiences in the past have been guided experiences throughout history. They're not typically things that people do on their own. There's usually like a shaman or a medicine man or somebody who's helping to guide this experience. And it seems like from a therapeutic standpoint, or even from, I don't know, just like a personal growth standpoint, having somebody to assist with that helps.
Well, and another thing too is like having someone who's experienced and know what's going on, and you come out of this somewhat chaotic experience and you're maybe confused, you don't understand what you're feeling, you're emotional.
Right.
And then having someone to sort of be relatable and talk you down, so to speak, from the ledge. And, you know, and it's funny that we're talking about anthropological uses of psychedelics, you know, like the list of mysteries and stuff, which would be like arguably the fathers of democracy, you know, like the Athenian elites and all these old like Socrates and Plato and all these people and Aristotle going and doing the derivative of LSD, which is ergot, which is actually like a fungus that grows on rye. And it was all actually like worshipers of Demeter and Persephone. It was all like these female priestesses that over time, like, and ergot's actually quite dangerous. You can really die on that stuff.
I think there's a really big case study of that in France, wasn't there?
Well, and ergot is commonly infecting like grain stores. And that's actually a common occurrence, even still now. It's not as if this is some weird little fungus that no one knows about. But it is, you know, Albert Hofmann actually synthesized LSD from ergot.
Right.
And so, and you know, you have the Greeks, you have, you know, the Aztecs, the Amazonian tribes, you know, like pretty much you can look around the world and there is some sort of psychedelic that exists there. And even like Abigain. The Bawadi tribe have been using that for thousands of years. You know, when you look at pictographs in Egypt of mushrooms and, you know, it's...
I was just having this conversation with somebody the other day about how you can find it spills over into either organized religion or some holidays, right? Like,
well, even Christianity. You know,
toadstool mushrooms, right? Red and white. Well, reindeers are involved.
Oh, dude, totally.
Santa Claus.
Like. Actually, and that's based on Amanita muscaria, which is muscal, which is the psychedelic component in Amanita muscaria. And, you know, when the Roman Empire was expanding rather brutally, aggressively, and, you know, they would reach an impasse with whatever tribes and be like, hey, how about this? How about you become Christian? Like the Holy Roman Empire. And we'll trade some stories back and forth so you guys don't feel completely left out and we're good to go. And Santa Claus was actually a version of these reindeer worshiping shaman who would go around the winter solstice, which incidentally is around Christmas, and they would pick Amanita muscaria mushrooms, which grow underneath evergreen trees and poplar, but evergreen trees. And actually, because they need to be treated there's anecdotal evidence that they would feed them to the reindeer and then drink the reindeer urine.
Right.
Which, you know, in context, whatever.
I mean, it's accurate because I think if you look at northern indigenous tribes in Russia as well as Canada, similar thing, they would actually follow the reindeers around and essentially drink reindeer
urine. Well, if you ate Amanita muscaria mushroom, there's a lot of stomach discomfort you would experience. Is very unpleasant.
Right.
There's like dizziness and nausea and diarrhea and so forth. But, you know, at that time to achieve these states of divinity, if you might want to call them that, they would drink the reindeer urine, go around with their reindeer, with these mushrooms that are red and white, that grow underneath evergreen trees. If you can't see the similarity to Santa Claus, then I don't know. And then, you know,
I don't think you've spelt it out enough.
And then flying reindeer with a head full of hallucinogens is not that far of a stretch. And I'm sure there's all kinds of people like, why would you say this about Christmas? And I'm like, well, you know, sorry. It is what it is.
It's just life. Like we said, like the Elysian Island, like that's Greek times. Like this is not, psychedelics are not new medications.
No. And the Aztecs actually referred to psilocybin as flesh of the gods.
Right.
And their religious structure was very much based around these experiences. You know, and even like I think psilocybin was sort of first discovered by Gordon Wasson, and he was, you know, a banker investment guy. And he actually was sort of this part-time explorer, and he went to Mexico, and there's this, I want to say tribal village, and Maria Sabina was sort of this mushroom shaman. And she sort of started this whole thing with giving him the experience, and he took it and he brought it back to North America. Time magazine did a cover spread on it, a bunch of different magazines.
Right.
And then sort of started the psychedelic revolution with other components, obviously, in the States. And so, you know, still it's all based on old traditions. And ayahuasca has been in the rainforest for thousands of years of people doing this. And it's, you know, it's funny that we did our best to erase this from our culture.
But only, I would say only in the Western world, like
realistically. Well, the Western world imposed that very harshly. Like, you know, there's a lot of countries that,
I mean, like,
they had to.
In South America, they're still performing these ceremonies with ayahuasca.
Yeah, but even in the States, though, there were exemptions eventually to like native tribes with peyote and mescaline and stuff like that. But it was a hard go because I think the general idea, like the Steger's Dog Bill, was just fundamentally across the board, we're going to start the process of making all these substances controlled and eliminating them.
Right.
And part of it, I think, was that the powers that be were probably afraid. Like, it's difficult to control people when they think independently.
Well, and again, we kind of talked about this at another time. Really, it seemed to be, you know, Harry Anslinger started the war on opiate drugs in the early, like after Prohibition in the 20s and 30s. Mm-hmm. That was more so against marginalized communities in the United States.
Yeah, it was racially motivated.
Yeah. And the United States had a lot of influence and power at that time because, you know, they were fairly well off. Europe was recovering from some things.
From some things. What are you talking about?
I don't know. It's just a blank slate from 1930 to 1946. Anyways, but then it migrated into, you know, post 1960s Vietnam, Korean wars, and you had a lot of these soldiers coming back that were now starting to be anti-establishment, and we kind of had that revolution, like the hippie revolution of the 70s, kind of came up with this revitalization of LSD and mushrooms and
And the anti-war movement was integral to that. You know, the one thing though that I find is that that whole hippie movement in that time period in the 60s and in the 70s wasn't that many people.
No,
like, but it was, don't get me wrong, and they made a big impact.
Yeah.
But it wasn't that many people, and the contrast was so great against modern society that they themselves by contrast became so prominent, and that movement became so significant.
Well, it's just like the loudest people in the room are usually the ones that are heard only,
or
by
the most colorful people in the room.
And that's,
or
that's,
you know what I mean?
Like, well, loud can take different forms.
Yeah, Ken Kesey and Timothy, you know. Yeah.
But yeah, kind of what I was saying, just I know I'm hijacking this a little bit. You know, this war on people thinking for themselves in the 70s, that's kind of really where we saw the clamping down, because it led into the 80s.
Well, Reagan, man.
Reagan and Nixon, right?
And those commercials in the 90s, this is your brain on drugs. Oh, I took that to heart, man. like I remember, and I still did drugs, but you know, I was more concerned when I was right. doing them. You know, I'm like doing
to
mushrooms.
This,
when
to
I'm
this
like
day,
15.
I'm still horrified of the concept of cocaine and all the wires in my brain being just randomly cut.
Well, I know. Or they the fried
although,
egg one.
Although I think those were Canadian only ads. I don't know if they were in the United States. Do you know?
I feel like they were American ads because they were the war on drugs ones. And then let's be realistic, half of Canadian TV is American TV.
Yeah, that's fair. Yeah, but that's 90s, more man. So later, like 2000s. Anyways, it doesn't matter. We're very much digressing here.
Yeah.
No.
But yeah, no, it was very much a very, like, and still too, like the war on drugs was a misinformation campaign.
100%. And again, like you said, it's people thinking for themselves. Unfortunately, yeah. these, and you've heard from other people in higher education that use psychedelics to break through on certain problems that they're having.
Yeah,
right?
Like microdosing LSD in Silicon Valley. And that's where I see the difference is that it's not just a singular demographic in society using psychedelics. It's mm-hmm. actually become more mainstream. And then when you start seeing these things on Netflix about ayahuasca and LSD and right. psilocybin and fantastic fungi and all that stuff, to me, that is so deeply optimistic
yep.
that this, you know, this haze of misinformation, this veneer of lies is slowly being torn down a bit. And people are starting to realize that these things are actually, you know, reduce neural inflammation. They can help you help yourself. And right. they're tools, right?
Yeah.
You know, I find that it's very unfortunate that in Western medicine, it's give me a pill so I can be fixed. I don't want to do anything. Yeah. I'm fat. Give me a pill so I can be skinny. I don't want to work out. Yeah. You know, I'm stupid. Give me a pill. Make me smart. Like limitless
quick fixes.
Yeah. Was the epitome of Western. Says, I would give me a pill so I can be smart. And like, yeah. well, I guess that's Adderall. Jesus. But
he's careful.
Yeah. I'm not endorsing that. Not endorsing that. And you know, to me that psychedelics are a tool that people can use to help themselves. And I think if people recognize that and don't think that they're going to do ayahuasca once and all of a sudden have other problems fixed, and just recognize that a lot of this is about being aware of that problem's existence and then using these psychedelics.
Again, these are all just tools, right?
Yeah.
Any tool requires effort to build something, right?
And if also you have helps a, having a skill set too.
If you have a saw sitting in your garage and planks of wood, it's not going to suddenly turn into a cabinet. You have to actually take and apply all of the tools that you have at your disposal
yeah.
in order to work on the problems that you have to face. And
yeah,
you know, again, you can microdose all day long. And if you're not willing to confront some of those things,
yeah.
it's not going to change the way that you
are. Like, you know, if someone was microdosing and then integrating that with some therapy or even just talking to friends and spouses about their problems or someone they trust, that's a hell of a lot better than, mm-hmm. you know, just watching reruns of Family Matters. Which, hey, that might be therapeutic too.
That
I don't know.
Could work. Hey, yeah. you get a large,
the moment
you get
I
a
said
large
it, I'm
enough.
Like, no, that actually might help.
And you get yeah. a large enough psilocybin dose.
Danny Cohen. Oh, Danny Tanner. There it
yeah,
is.
There you go. Yeah. Excellent. So speaking a little bit about this, obviously, you know, not every experience is the same. Mileage may vary with psychedelics.
Yeah, very much so.
We've talked a lot about the positives of psychedelics. Are there any negatives that people should be aware of? I know you talked about schizophrenia. That's kind of...
Well, okay. People with pre-existing psychosis issues, yeah. like things like schizophrenia and stuff like that, yeah. I would be very hesitant. If not, I'm extremely hesitant about doing psychedelics.
Right.
And even smoking pot and cannabis, because cannabis is a psychedelic as well, right? You know, if you have a chemical imbalance in your brain to start with schizophrenia, schizoaffective disorder, and all these different things.
There's pretty strong research that suggests
that you can
young males who yeah. use THC and they got a predisposition to
yeah, if you have the predisposition. It might be arguable that you're probably going to go that direction anyways.
Right.
But again, I'm not going to make that argument because I'm a psychiatrist.
I was going to say, if you're standing in front of a cliff and somebody gives you a really hard push from the back.
Yeah, it's, you know, yeah. and so you might have ended up that way anyways, but at right. the same time, why, you know, if you have a strong family history of psychiatric conditions. Mm-hmm. God, talk to your doctor, talk to someone. I don't know. They're probably going to tell you no, but just maybe don't do it.
Yeah.
You know? And again, too, right? Like, I find it funny that people always like, I don't want to have a bad trip. And like, grow up. Mm. You know, if you know, people always have this thing. I don't want everyone to feel bad. And if I feel bad, something's wrong. I'm like, no, feeling bad's part of life.
The human experience.
Yeah. And this idea that we always need to perpetually feel good about ourselves and our lives and all these different things. I'm like, you know, you need contrast. You know, for me, like, it's like being sick. Every now and then I don't mind getting like the flu or something because then not being sick is awesome as opposed to just being normal. And so people who are like, I want to have a bad trip. And I'm like, yeah, well, that's part of it. Like I've frequently described doing a large dose of mushrooms or ayahuasca or something to be like, man, that was the equivalent of like 12 hours of intensive therapy.
But typically those bad trips are also, I think, as you've described in the past, people who have a hard time letting go.
Yeah. And that's an interesting statement, which I'm surprised I didn't bring up earlier, is that to me, you know, the vast majority of all the angst people feel is that they just can't let go. Like, people have this idea, like, I don't want to lose control. And it's like, what do you think you're in control of?
Right.
You know,
control really is an illusion. To be honest, it is.
Like, people are in control of absolutely nothing.
Yeah.
You know, you're maybe in control of how you interpret things on a, like, psychological level, but even that is probably a very loose statement.
You're just reinforcing my statement earlier where I said the world is chaos and we're just trying to organize it.
Fair enough.
Yeah.
Fair enough.
The illusion of control.
Yeah. And that's what we struggle to do because it makes us feel safe. But at the end of the day, you know, this desire to control things around you is exhausting and it leads to anxiety. And so people who are like, I'm afraid to lose control. I'm like, you know, you'd be surprised at how liberating quote unquote losing control is. Mm. And losing control to me, it's like, it's just, you're just letting go.
Yeah.
You know, we're white knuckling the steering wheel in our car of life as we're careening down some highway or whatever. And, you know, it's just sit back, put on autopilot and just take a break for a couple minutes and just, you know, let things be. And then again, that's a very much oversimplification of a psychedelic experience. But fundamentally, like to me and all my experiences with ego deaths and DMT and 5-MeO-DMT and all these different things, it's all been letting go. Letting go of all the nonsense that we really have no control over and recognizing that and being okay with it because we don't have control over anything. Yeah. And so, you know, we'll take a minute to talk about Avail. So
definitely
Avail Scientific is a company out of London, Ontario. It's publicly traded. Technically it's an American company, but it works within Canada and employs Canadians. Its basic goal is to fundamentally legitimize psychedelics, and it's licensed and working with mushroom farms and clinics and various people and laboratories and scientists and so forth and developing different delivery methods that make these medications and therapeutics more accessible to people. Because sometimes, you know, the method to ingest them is a little esoteric.
Right.
Like, you know, you're vaporizing in this elaborate pipe DMT, which is not reasonable.
Right.
And so, you know, making orally ingested by nanoizing and so forth and aerosolization. And yeah, I just want to say that I
think that also legitimizes it as a medication right? Does. Because if you have something that's coming to you, either eat this piece
of cactus, right. You know, to brush the dirt off and eat this or eat this brew and, you know, it's drink this, do that. And it unfortunately has a tendency to reinforce a stereotype and stigma that's associated with it.
Right. And again, that's kind of their mandate at Avail Scientific, right? Is just normalizing all of these things because they are medications.
They are. And I think sometimes they're even beyond medications. You know, like to me, and this is a conversation I want to have with someone in the very near future on another episode, is the origin of consciousness, the exploration of consciousness.
Right.
And, you know, when people are commonly using the term expand your consciousness with psychedelics, and I completely understand what that means, but it's a difficult thing to talk about. And I think that is something very interesting that we don't even know what consciousness is. Mm. You know, we're organic computer with billions of neurons that just on and off like 0101 and a billion of 0101s is us having this conversation. So, you know, this notion of complexity and emergence from all these individual things working in unison, creating consciousness, but yet no one even knows what consciousness is, where it comes from. And like, it's amazing. You ask a neuroscientist, what is consciousness? And more than likely they're going to be like, I don't know.
Where is it located?
Yeah. Really? And your pineal gland. And you're like, oh, yeah, okay.
Well, like, it depends on who you ask. Some people say it's in the soul, and then that gets in a whole different conversation.
Now you're in this non-tangible thing. Although it is funny that a friend of mine's a quantum physicist, and I want to interview him sometime. Mm-hmm. Although I'm going to have to like, man, you need to dumb down what you're talking about.
Can we just pause for a second? You know a lot of very interesting people.
No,
and
I do.
I think that's why this leads very well into a podcast, because you have the right people at your disposal and you know the right people to have these conversations with.
And then they know interesting people too.
Exactly.
So yeah.
Six degrees.
Well, it's like a friend of mine. Yeah. He's a quantum physicist. Absolutely brilliant. And I was talking about psychedelics with him and, you know, my dad, and he actually did a death experience on, you know, these experiences themselves, which was kind of interesting. Mm-hmm. He just couldn't wait to talk to me when I got to the hospital. He was like, I'm like, I know you want to talk to me. I'll talk to you. Don't worry. This isn't inappropriate. And yeah, so we were talking about the ideas, and not soul necessarily, but about these experiences and collective consciousnesses. And I know from all my psychedelic experience and my death experience that I personally believe that we're all just facets of an infinite complexity, like an infinite consciousness that was just experiencing itself subjectively through the lens of individual life. Whether it's a blade of grass, a dog, a cat, a dolphin, a porpoise, whatever. And it's just experiencing self-subjectively. And we were talking about that. And he's like, well, there's no proof of it. I'm like, yeah, but do you believe in dark matter? He's like, well, yeah, it has to be there. I'm like, yeah, but you can't measure it. You don't know it's there. The only reason you believe in it, because that mass has to be there for the universe to work the way it works.
Based on your math.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. For our galaxy not to splinter apart and fly out, there has to be this invisible mass that no one can measure or see. And I'm like, but you're willing to believe in that, but you're not going to believe in this. And I kind of stumped him on that, which was good because I never stumped him on anything. Yeah. And, you know, and I feel like subsequently since he's taken a softer approach to a lot of these different things.
Right.
But it, really though, like, you know, it's subjectiveness. And even another friend of mine, he's a staunch atheist. And I'm like, you know, there's no difference from being a staunch atheist to being a fanatical religious person. There's no evidence of either. You know what I mean? If for you, if it's a logic presumption that some form of theological existence is the most logical thing, then fine. But you know, you're still just guessing.
And we're all just fighting in the same sandbox with different arguments, right?
Yeah, no, it's funny. Yeah. So yeah. So anyways, Avail Scientific's awesome. Check out the webpage, www.availscientific.com. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram and all those other fancy things. We're actually putting a publication too of science, trying to legitimize and educate physicians and people on psychedelics, much like the purpose of this podcast.
Right.
Yeah, it's coming.
And this podcast being tapping into psychedelics. And like I said, we're going to be on all major formats for where you can find your podcasts, Stitcher, iTunes, all that fun stuff. So please smash and hit that like and subscribe button.
Damn you for saying that. Yeah,
you're welcome.
But smash it, whatever.
Smash it.
Yeah, so yeah. Hope you guys enjoyed our ramblings. Perhaps they were coherent at times.
Yeah, I know this isn't mine, but I want to thank you for sharing the experiences that you've gone through, because honestly, they're a little gut-wrenching. They're hard to get through and to talk about. And they're very raw emotional experiences. So the fact that you're able to sit here and talk about those
is funny. That I don't even find it that way at all.
No,
but I mean, or maybe I should, because it actually seems like I'm doing more effort. Yeah, I actually was crying the entire time.
Yeah. I mean, you got a little misty. You can't deny that.
Well, and thank you for lending your sultry voice, handsome Jason. I appreciate that.
No problem. And it sounds like this podcast is going to be what format? Monthly? Biweekly?
Yeah, we're going to be doing it monthly.
Monthly.
And you know, we're going to have mycologists, neuroscientists, physicists, psychiatrists, addiction doctors. You know, I think addiction is something that's very much worth an entire episode because of the promise of psychedelics and potentially treating the underlying causes of addiction.
And even just talking about what addiction is, because I think there's a misconception about all drugs are kind of classified in the same thing.
And the idea that addiction is a choice.
Right.
Like somebody wants to be homeless and degrading physically.
Save that for another episode.
Yeah, totally. That could go on for hours on that.
Exactly.
All right, man. Awesome.
Thank you.
See you later, homie.